The post-mortem has begun on a historic set of local elections, but where does each party go from here? Is Reform unstoppable? Is Kemi the one to lead the Conservative rebuild? And do Labour really get it? On Wednesday, the 7th of May, join the Spectators panel and special guests Zia Youssef and Jacob Rees-Mogg to unpack these questions as well as the broader implications of the local elections on British politics. For tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/coffeehouselive.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Lucy Dunn and this is the first in a series of episodes where I'll be speaking to a variety of Scottish politicians in the lead up to the 2026 Scottish Parliament elections after a rather tumultuous 5 years in Scottish politics. Today I'm joined by the Holyrood leader of the pro-independence ALBA party, Ash Regan. Ash was formerly a member of the SNP and even ran to be the party's leader after Nicola Sturgeon resigned in 2023. She defected to the late Alex Salmond's ALBA party 18 months ago and ran to be party leader after he passed away. She narrowly lost to Kenny McCaskill but remains a prominent voice in the Scottish Parliament. So Ash, thanks very much for joining us. So it's been a busy few years in Scottish politics, and I can imagine things will be getting even busier in the run-up to next year's Holyrood elections. You're in quite a different position from previous elections, aren't you? Given, you know, the last Holyrood Parliament election, you stood under the SNP banner, but now you're standing as an ALBA party candidate. Sort of, can you tell us a little bit about that and how it's changed?
Yeah, so if I'd have kept my head down and prioritised my career, like many of my former SNP colleagues, then no doubt I'd be contesting my former SNP constituency seat that I had held for two cycles. So yeah, I've been in for 9 years, elected under the SNP both times, last time with a 52% of the vote in 2021. That seat actually, because of boundary changes, does not now exist. So the Boundary Commission have been working their magic, shall we say, over the constituencies in Scotland. And my goodness, most of them are completely unrecognisable. So the seat doesn't exist anymore. You know, had I still been part of the SNP, I'd had to have made a choice about, you know, where I was going to stand. I won't have to do that now, obviously, because I'm no longer in the SNP, because obviously I left primarily over the Scottish government's handling of women's rights and to do with gender reform issues, but also to do with their, I felt, kind of lack of strategy or making any progress on the issue of Scottish independence. And so I'm now with a much smaller party, ALBA, which, you know, some polls is showing that we might be lucky and pick up something like 8 seats. And then in other polls, we're just not registering at all, which I think is, you know, normal, as the pollsters really do tend to struggle a little bit with smaller, newer parties in trying to figure out exactly where we might end up.
And we'll come on to talk about some of the women's rights issues that I think have been prominent recently. But just before we do that, I suppose, thinking about how ALBA is approaching the Holyrood elections, you know, what would you say is the party's pitch to the public ahead of next year?
Well, the polling is all over the place, and it really seems to be saying that the public are just fed up with all the main parties. And there is obviously quite a strong showing for Reform, which obviously currently in Scotland don't have any MSPs. There's no member of the Scottish Parliament at the moment. And the most recent poll that I saw had them on about 12%. That means they, if that continues, they will pick up seats in the next Scottish election next year. But it's, you know, it's quite hard to say at the moment how that's going to go forward. Kenny obviously, you know, won the leadership contest. I think it's fair to say that his view of where we should be going as a party, my view, were quite different. I felt that we need, as a party, to really be addressing the public's concerns. I mean, that's why people are saying they're going to be voting Reform, because they're fed up with the main parties. So to my mind, there's no point going out there and just being a smaller version of the main parties, repeating the same things that they're saying. So I wanted to take us in a completely different direction and be a bit more honest with the public and reflect back to them where they were on some of the, what I think will be the key issues of the next election. I mean, one of them particularly, I mean, obviously I wanted to make us put a very bold strategy forward on Scottish independence. But, you know, the other thing is really cost of living. I think that it feels as if in Scotland, and I'm sure this is the same in other parts of the UK, that the social contract, if you like, between the public and the government and the way the government is delivering is kind of starting to break down. I think people feel like they're doing everything right. You know, they're law abiding and they're doing everything they've been told and they're paying into the system, but they're just not getting back what I think they might have anticipated that they would have, you know, 20 years ago. It doesn't feel like people are being looked after by the public services in the way that they had been before. And no one seems to be able to address that. Now, you know, it probably the case that if Reform get elected, they won't be able to address it either, because some of these things are very complicated and challenging. But I do think with the main parties, there is very much a reluctance to even go there. They don't even really want to talk about some of the issues that the public wants to talk about. And I can talk to you about the summit that the First Minister had, I think it was last week.
I suppose you mentioned that anti-reform summit, or that summit where John Swinney pulled people from across the political spectrum in Holyrood to discuss. Well, I'm sure. Well, I hope you tell us a little bit about that and what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing to say, you know, they spent quite a lot of time saying that it wasn't an anti-reform summit. And yet that, I suppose we say with politics that perception becomes reality. So that's certainly the way that everybody, you know, in the outside of Holyrood was perceiving it. Russell Finlay, he's obviously the leader of the Scottish Conservatives, said right at the beginning that he wouldn't be going. It'd be a talking shop. I, you know, had some sympathy with, I guess, what Russell was setting out, but I thought it was probably worthwhile intending just to see, you know, maybe things had shifted, get an idea of what perhaps civic society across Scotland, you know, these were leaders from the third sector and so on, and the way that they were thinking about things. But actually being in that room, I could tell that it was, you know, I would consider myself to be anti-woke. And I would say that it just was, it was very much one view of how Scotland should be. There wasn't very much dissent. There was no debate about anything. I mean, I sat there for a couple of occasions of certain people were speaking, and I just thought these people and the way that they sort of conceptualize things and the way that they think about Scotland is so far distant from the average person outside, the average voter, and how they think about things and the things that they're concerned about. That's a problem. It's a problem that the First Minister thought that was a good cross-section of people. Obviously, the part, you know, Reform were excluded. You know, that's probably, you know, if this is meant to be democracy, that's a problem. Because my view would be that if the public are fed up and they want to vote for, I mean, what we're calling Reform a protest party, and they want to do that, that's up to the public. That's democracy. And arguably, the job of the main parties, and even the job of the smaller other parties, is to make a case that's so appealing to the electorate that they don't have to go there.
Absolutely. And I think I saw in some quarters people were characterising it as maybe slightly condescending to, you know, a large enough group of people who are attracted towards Reform for a variety of different reasons. I suppose, and on that note, thinking about the party, particularly north of the border, you know, it sort of started up around about 2021, so in many ways similar time to ALBA, and it has seen in recent years its popularity grow exponentially, you know, partly due to Nigel Farage's campaigning efforts down south. You know, do you think in some ways there's actually lessons with how Reform have gained traction in Scotland that other political parties would do well to learn from?
I'm not sure, because I think they exist in a very specific, I guess, media bubble. I don't know how else to describe that, that obviously people understand that Nigel Farage attracts, or maybe has cultivated, it's probably not by accident, you know, is attracting a very, very high level of media. You know, if we think about the number of times that he's been a guest, for instance, on some of the panel shows that BBC runs, you know, no one else could even think about getting that much media coverage. So he's you know, it's unusual in that perspective. And I can understand why the media do it. You know, he shakes things up, he's challenging, you know, it creates controversy, you know, which, you know, media love, because they want things to be exciting and interesting. And arguably, that's where Scottish politics is today. I've just come out of First Minister's Questions. It was very dull, you know, and I think that I've heard that from the media in Scotland recently, that they find it very dull. Scottish politics seems quite dull. We're in in the run-up to an election, you're probably in this sort of limbo situation where everyone's just waiting to see what's going to happen next. And I do think that sometimes the things that are debated and the way that they're talked about in the Scottish Parliament is very distant. Sometimes it feels to me like it's performative, you know, it's like virtue signalling performative politics, where everyone's trying to out-compete with each other to show how perfect they can be on certain issues.
Yeah, thinking about sort of campaigning next year, I mean, you've kind of talked about polling and sort of some polls saying that ALBA might pick up 7-8 MSPs, others maybe sort of, you know, less generous. But I suppose, you know, the message that you're putting across just now is something that I'm sure a lot of voters would resonate with, sort of about the dullness and maybe sort of insular character of Scottish Parliament and Scottish politics. Yeah. Going forward with that message, where are your expectations at, do you think, for ALBA next year in terms of, you know, campaigning? And I was going to ask as well, is ALBA going to contest both the list seats and the constituencies, or has it got a slightly different strategy this time?
So ALBA was formed, I think, and I actually think Alex Hammond had the right idea at the time. You know, when he launched the party in the run-up to the 2021 elections, this idea of the supermajority for independence party, because for anybody that's not familiar with the Scottish, you know, the way that the Scottish votes happen, we always have constituency and then we have list. And if you're very successful in the constituency, then you end up not doing very well on the list because it's a way of creating part proportional representation. So what happened was that a lot of people in Scotland, you know, voted for the SNP or pro-independence parties, and then they on the list, they didn't get the representation there. And there's this sort of famous phrase, which is, you know, a million votes wasted for independence on the list. So the idea behind ALBA was to give people another opportunity to vote for independence to maximise the number of pro-independence seats in the parliament, which I think was a good strategy. It made sense. I don't think at the time there was enough of a run-up to the election in order to, despite, you know, the fact that obviously Alex Salmond was a big beast in Scottish politics, to really get that message across to the public and have them understand it in time to cast their votes. I think that has changed now. I think the public do understand that. And I think there is maybe an appetite to maximise the pro-independence votes. But you would only do that, and the public would only be interested in doing that, if they felt that there was a reason to do that. And at the moment, the SNP don't see, there's no coherent strategy that I'm hearing that's coming from the SNP that are suggesting, you know, that if you were to vote, you know, for the SNP or another pro-independence party, what they would do with the pro-independence majority. What are they going to do with it? How are they going to move this constitutional question forward? And there isn't anything. You know, obviously, I made a couple of suggestions of things we could do, you know, that I was voted down. You know, the SNP saying they're not going to consider that. So there's one option there. It's very difficult, Laura, you know, coming back to that, for small parties to cut through. And the other thing is that reform also challenges us. So yes, reform are going to be a huge thorn in the side for the Conservatives. We know this. They're also eating into the Labour Party's vote, and to a lesser degree, to the SNP vote as well. We know that people who might consider voting reform were the type of people who might have voted SNP in times gone by, but also voted for Brexit. So there is crossover here across for all the main parties. But if we're coming back to the Scottish voting system and, you know, reform are going to be picking up seats on the list, it's not really a national picture with the list. It's very much 8 individual elections. And the more parties that are vying for seats on the list, the harder it's going to be for the you know, smaller parties like ALBA to get them.
Fine. And you just to sort of go back to that sort of list point, is ALBA only going to contest seats on the regional
list? Yes. So that's right. So, you know, again, if we go back to my example, you know, when I stood for the SNP and I wasn't alone in this, getting 52% of the vote, you know, clearly ALBA at the moment, you know, I don't know if we're polling. It usually runs around something like 4%, 5%, you know, something like that. So we'd be very unlikely to be able to secure any constituency seats. And so it would make sense, I think, for us to be a list-only party, which is what we've decided to do for this next election.
Absolutely. And I suppose moving on to recent events, we saw the other week that the Supreme Court judgment backed the biological definition of a woman. You know, this is an issue, I think, very close to your heart. You rose to prominence after quitting Nicola Sturgeon's government over the Gender Reform Bill, and you've long been a vocal campaigner on women's rights. So I'd be quite interested to hear your thoughts on, first of all, the ruling, but second of all, the reaction from politicians in Scotland and Holyrood to this judgment.
Yes. I mean, clearly it was an incredibly significant moment. It was about 2 weeks ago now, wasn't it? I didn't go down to London. So forum in Scotland, there's really just 3 of them. So 2 of them were in London to go to the Supreme Court to take part in what was happening down there. And then obviously speak to the media afterwards. And one, Trina, was in Edinburgh. And they wanted to have, you know, a gathering of, I guess, the people that had been important and people that had campaigned on this with them over the last few years in Edinburgh as well. And but I was very glad I was in Edinburgh, because when it went our way, we were able to celebrate. And we obviously went off to have, you know, a couple of glasses of fizz and everything, and we were celebrating. But then in the afternoon, it kind of struck me, and I went into this sort of phase where I felt a bit maudlin about it all, because I just thought there's so much energy and money. And, you know, so many people had lost so much through this fight. You know, I would include myself in that, you know, but I'm not alone in that. You know, there are lots of women and some men who have had their reputations trashed over this, where people just stood by or people left them. That people that have been, I mean, Sandy Peggy's a great example of this, you know, people that have been in careers where they've had an unblemished service record for, in her case, for 30 years. And then she expresses discomfort and disquiet about being forced to change with a biological male in the women's changing, and she's suspended from her job. people that have had their publishing deals cancelled, you know, people that have just been cancelled from public life. You know, so much has been lost throughout this. And it just felt like in some ways it was almost ridiculous to have come completely full circle, to come back to what we always knew had to be the case. It had to be the case that women were biological women and that that had to be the case in law. So in some ways it's quite frustrating to have, you know, for people to have put so much on the line for all of this. On another level, obviously it's good that we have now have this clarity, and it's good that I think, and I feel this as myself, I feel like I'm a campaigning politician now at this point. We feel that we have won, you know, a very sizable victory in this, and that hopefully this is the beginning of this ideology being unpicked and rolled back from, you know, our public services in Scotland, although I know this is an issue in England as well. But I have to say that the Scottish Government's response to this was, and I shouldn't be surprised at this point, I really shouldn't, because I've, you know, been through this fight for the, you know, for however many years this has gone on for now, quite a few, maybe six, I guess, when I first, I think it was 2019, when I first signed an open letter that went to the newspapers and appeared on the front page. And that was 2019. So it's been quite a long time. And so the government stood up, and the two most notable aspects of the government statement, or three, I should say, that came out of this was, one, a week had gone by and they'd done absolutely nothing. So that was the first thing. No action had been taken. And if you think about it, there were some quite serious consequences that had been, you know, that are happening in Scotland. One of the obvious ones would be that there's male body prisoners in the women's females in the female prison estate. So that was something they could have done in the first week. They could have just said, oh, right, we got this wrong. We better comply with this, the law as we now know it is, and we'll sort that out. So they've done absolutely nothing. And the second one is we were still being, people like me, we're still being lectured on our tone. Just the government loves to do this. It loves to go out in front and it'll spend at least a whole page of a speech going on about the tone and how we must all be respectful and how people's rights were on the line and people were feeling afraid and this and that. But the problem with this is the people whose rights were being taken away and the people who were afraid and the people who were being suspended from their jobs and the people that were had risked so much and whose reputations were being trashed were women. And at no point did the government say, you know, oh, I'd like to extend, you know, some sympathy to the women who have lost so much through this fight and that, you know, finally this has been restored and now everyone's rights are on the same level. No, they didn't. They didn't talk about that at all. And so you still felt like you were being, even though you were right about this all along, you were the one that was being patronized. So that was the second thing. And then the third thing is that they're using the regulator. So in this case, it's the EHRC. They're using the regulator as almost like a deflector shield, where they're saying, oh, well, you know, we can't do anything because we need to hear from the regulator. They will give us the guidance and then we will know how to interpret the law. Well, I'm sorry, but no. You know, the judgment's very clear, 88 pages. The government need to govern. Otherwise, what's the point in having a government? They need to do what government does and they need to set out exactly how, you know, the third sector and the public sector across Scotland are going to be on the right side of the law and protect women's human rights. And they're not doing that and they're still not doing it. And in fact, you know, John Swinney still does not seem to be able to answer the question, what is a woman? And no one has apologized. So, which I think is a major problem. You know, I resigned because I knew this was wrong. I knew it was wrong in terms of policy. I knew it was wrong. It was going to be wrong legally. I knew it was going to cause problems. I knew that it possibly would harm, you know, women and girls. And I resigned because I was not going to be part of that. So now we're in a position where the Scottish government has been roundly humiliated in the highest court in the land by basically three ordinary Scottish mums who fought them all the way to the Supreme Court and then beat them. And yet nobody has been held accountable for that. Nobody has said, oh yeah, well, we did push this through and we made a mistake. You know, they haven't even apologized, never mind resigned over it. And I think that shows there's a deep, deep problem in politics now. You know, when I was growing up, so I was born in the 70s, there was always this thing, you know, if politicians were caught out or they did something wrong or, you know, everybody would resign, you'd resign. You know, if you'd done something wrong, nobody resigns anymore. Nobody takes any accountability for anything. And so, and then we wonder why the public are fed up with politicians and fed up with the main political parties. Well, this is a good example of why, because they've been gaslighting the public for years. Now they've been found out and they still can't hold their hands up and say, oh, you know, we made a mistake. We're going to fix it.
I mean, it'd be interesting to see how things do progress, you know, in terms of, as you say, looking at the practical steps and moving forward. Just sort of a final question to round up. What would you say, just in a single sentence, over the last couple of years, reflecting on your political career, is your biggest regret and, second of all, your biggest success?
Well, despite everything I've said about us going around in circles, I think the thing that I'm the gladdest that I did was the fact that I did stand up for women, girls, and I did resign. So yes, it's had some, you know, it's had, you know, consequences and a cost to me for doing that in a whole number of ways, which I won't go into, but definitely that, because I felt like I'd nailed my colours to the mast when it was very difficult to do it. And you know, I'm really glad that I did and I participated in that. And I've made some amazing friends through all the women that campaign on this issue. But in terms of what I regret the most, I think that would be that I didn't manage to make more progress on prostitution law reform when I was in post in government. And so in order to try to counteract that, I'm in the process of doing a members bill. So I'm doing a members bill. It's called Unbuyable, and it's reforming prostitution law to shift the balance of criminality onto the buyer, because it's the buyer that creates the market for prostitution and, you know, are exploiting often what are, you know, women and some men in very vulnerable situations. And it's going to be lodged formally in the Scottish Parliament in just 3 weeks' time. So I'll be able to hopefully come back and talk to you a bit more about it in the future.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, and really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Not at all. Thank you.